use of public dollars to go after the problem that seems to be biggest in your state.
Locke says the goal of the research is to offer people pathways to better brain health and to give older Americans more quality time with their loved ones. The findings were released by the new Dementia Risk Reduction Project, a collaboration between AARP, the Alzheimer's Disease Data Initiative, and the University of Washington. This is Eric Galatis.
More than 5.3 million people across the U.S. enrolled in a Marketplace health insurance plan from November 1st through December 4th. As Kathleen Shannon reports, an important deadline is coming up this Sunday.
Open enrollment for health insurance is underway. Experts advise there's an important deadline this weekend. According to the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, nearly 988,000 new U.S. consumers enrolled in health plans through the marketplace between November 1st and December 4th. Caleb Smith with Enroll Wyoming says those who want coverage starting January 1st must enroll by this Sunday, December 15th.
This deadline is something that we ask people to be mindful of so they can hopefully avoid a gap in health coverage. I'd hate for people to delay action or just forgo trying to get medical help just because they weren't covered.
Open enrollment runs until January 15th, but those who wait until the last month to sign up won't be covered under their new plans until February 1st. Smith says some families are surprised at the discounts they qualify for following pandemic-era increases to advanced premium tax credits.
I certainly know a number of people, they've done this a couple times, they just appreciate somebody kind of looking over their homework to go like, yeah, you got it.
I'm Kathleen Shannon.
You're listening to an end-of-year membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem, Eliza Yurkov, Eric Tegedoff, Isabel Charlet, and Kathleen Shannon. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One. Our evening news director is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I am Annette Newell. Glad to have you with us. All of our KBOO programs are made possible by support from our members. KBOO is currently in our end-of-year fundraising drive, and our goal is to raise $75,000 by December 31st. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News In Depth up next.
Welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest with Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. It's critical commentary on foreign affairs from a human interest perspective. The opinions expressed in the following segment are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest. I'm Mel Gertov. I'll be reporting and commenting on the most important and sometimes the most neglected international news of the week. Here are today's top stories. Syria's collapse, drugs, immigration, and Trump's tariff wars, and Ukraine is prepared to trade land for peace. First, Syria's collapse. The rebellion that originated in Syria's civil war in 2011 has overthrown the 24-year-long rule of Bashar al-Assad. At least three forces appear to comprise the rebellion, with Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, HTS, whose name means Organization for the Liberation of the Levant, the most important. The civil war has displaced about half the population. Around 6 million people sought safety in neighboring countries and Europe, 1 million in Germany alone. Whether or not they return home, how the new regime treats all the civilians and soldiers who served in the Assad regime, and what kind of relationship the STS has with other armed groups are among the many questions that will affect security and stability in the years ahead. In an interview with CNN, the leader of the rebel group, Abu Muhammad al-Jalani, said little about his goals beyond overthrowing the Assad regime and establishing a pluralistic society. But the HTS's Islamist roots and Jalani's one-time fighting for al-Qaeda led the U.S. and other countries in 2018 to label HTS a terrorist organization. Will that tag remain now that HTS is in charge? An HTS-led government is likely to be hostile to Iran and perhaps open to a cooperative relationship with Israel and Saudi Arabia. Though Israel has taken control of the buffer zone it shares with Syria, is conducting hundreds of air attacks on Syrian military sites, and is driving deeper into Syria beyond the Golan Heights that Israel annexed in 1981. Russia and Iran are the big losers in Syria's collapse. Both have lost a key Middle East ally. None made an effort to save Assad, who has fled with his family and is now residing in Moscow. Hezbollah has also lost a channel for aid from Iran. As for the U.S., the Biden administration and Donald Trump made clear as the rebellion unfolded that the U.S. would not and should not be involved. That is sensible, but the fact is that the U.S. is involved. There are around 900 U.S. soldiers and contract personnel working with the Kurdish forces in northern Syria. And Biden revealed that the U.S. is carrying out airstrikes against ISIS units in Syria in order, he said, to keep it from taking advantage of the chaos. One cause for joy among many Syrians, the opening up of Assad's prisons, where, according to a Syrian human rights group, more than 130,000 people were subjected to arbitrary arrest and detention by the government. Tens of thousands were tortured, and one of Assad's sons was the man in charge. Drugs, immigration, and Trump's tariff wars. Donald Trump is continuing down the path of tying higher tariffs to fighting the drug war, specifically fentanyl imports. As usual, he blames immigrants for bringing drugs across the Mexico and Canada border. He announced that he will impose a 25% tariff on all goods coming from Mexico, Canada, and China, with an additional 10% on China, as a means of counteracting their role as a channel for fentanyl. Trouble is, one country's increase in tariffs compels a comparable response by the affected countries. China has a number of options. Cheapen the renminbi to fuel higher exports, move export markets away from the U.S., including to Mexico, and stop cooperating with the United States on fentanyl precursor production and marketing. As for Mexico, the new president, Claudia Sheinbaum, said she and Trump had agreed that there would be no trade war. But Trump said she had also agreed to shut down Mexico's border with the U.S. to keep immigrants out. She said otherwise, quote, "I can assure you, I guarantee you, that we never proposed that we would close the border in the north or in the south of the United States," unquote. She later said she hopes to reach an agreement with Trump so that, quote, "they can send people who come from other countries back to their countries of origin." Canada's Prime Minister Justin Trudeau took a different tack, traveling unannounced to Mar-a-Lago to reconsider the tariff increase. Canadian observers saw him as beseeching Trump, with hat in hand. All Trudeau would say is that he had a great conversation with Trump and would cooperate in keeping drugs and illegal immigrants from crossing the border. No indication from Trump that the U.S. will forego a tariff increase. While on the subject of Trump's tariff war, I might mention still another of his threats, this one directed at the BRICS countries, that's Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, which now also include Iran, Egypt, Ethiopia, and the United Arab Emirates, a threat of a 100% tariff increase if they don't drop their decision to de-dollarize. That decision was reached at their last summit meeting, which was held in Russia. At that meeting, the BRICS leadership, including Vladimir Putin, applauded the New Development Bank, a development financing bank that will use local currencies instead of the dollar to provide aid to global South countries. Trump said, quote, "The idea that the BRICS countries are trying to move away from the dollar while we stand by and watch is over." Trump said the U.S. would require a commitment from BRICS nations that they will neither create a new BRICS currency nor back any other currency to replace the mighty U.S. dollar, or they will face 100% tariffs, unquote. Putin has been among those leaders who argue that the U.S. has weaponized the dollar, forcing countries to use alternative currencies. Still, the dollar reigns supreme, accounting for nearly 60% of major international transactions. It will be interesting to see if Russia and China rely increasingly on other currencies, especially when it comes to avoiding Western sanctions. Ukraine is prepared to trade land for peace. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky said for the first time that Ukraine would be willing to give up, temporarily, land occupied by Russia in exchange for a peace agreement. But, he said, if we want to stop the hot stage of the war, we should take under the NATO umbrella the territory of Ukraine that we have under our control. Gaining NATO's protection has always been unacceptable to Putin and probably would also be unacceptable to the Trump administration. There are several variations on this kind of proposal. One is that Ukraine would not become a formal member of NATO, but would gain pledges of protection, an umbrella, from individual NATO member states, such as the US and France. Another is that Ukraine would forego NATO's protection for 20 years, then acquire it. A third variation, attributed to Trump, is that the current battle lines would be frozen. Ukraine would receive more weapons to deter Russia, but there would be nothing to prevent Russia from resuming its war. Zelensky surely senses that the tide is turning against fulsome military aid to his country in the U.S. and the European Union. His sudden flexibility on peace talks reflects his weakening position. Trump is in the wings in the U.S., the French government is in turmoil, and Germany's economy has hit the skids. Republicans in the House succeeded in stopping a Biden bill to provide Ukraine with another $50 billion in security aid, insisting, as they have in the past, on linking it to more border controls. Biden denounced the Republicans' move as showing they are, quote, willing to literally kneecap Ukraine on the battlefield and damage our national security in the process. In other news, the trade war with China escalates. Let's not forget that the Biden administration has followed and extended Trump-era restrictions on high-tech investments in and exports to China. On December 2nd, Biden unveiled a new set of restrictions on the sale to China of semiconductor manufacturing equipment and chips used in AI and advanced computing. The Commerce Department added 140 Chinese firms to the list of companies prohibited from doing business with U.S. counterparts. China's government responded by banning the export to the U.S. of two critical minerals, germanium and gallium, essential to production of semiconductors and solar cells. These negative developments in U.S.-China relations come despite some good news. An exchange of three Americans held in China, one an FBI informant, for two Chinese spies and one other Chinese citizen. Not revealed in this announcement, but discovered by the New York Times, is that three Uyghurs were allowed to leave China for the U.S. President Biden had appealed for the release of one of them when he last met Xi Jinping. A woman whose son, a human rights activist, was granted asylum in the U.S. after completing graduate studies. Next, Taiwan will buy more U.S. weapons. Clearly in response to Donald Trump's belief that Taiwan should pay more for U.S. support, the Taiwan Defense Ministry announced last week that it will spend at least $2.2 billion on American-supplied arms in 2025 after Trump takes office. Taiwan is open to suggestions. Quote, we welcome advice from all sides, with the most important thing being how to boost self-defense capacity, said a senior Taiwan security official. Well, he'll surely get some advice from Trump's Pentagon. This commitment to buy more weapons is on top of a $2 billion purchase of U.S. weapons in October that included advanced surface-to-air missiles, a sale that drew strong objections from Beijing. The Global Plastics Treaty talks collapse. A global treaty on plastics production and use collapsed for lack of a consensus. The major oil companies opposed limits on production and asserted that plastics pollution is the chief problem, while environmentalists and numerous national representatives insisted that a treaty must cover both production and pollution. As the Washington Post reported, quote, each year the world produces more than 450 million metric tons of plastic, mostly from fossil fuels, and generates 350 million metric tons of plastic waste. Around half of that waste is dumped into landfills, according to figures compiled by the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. Another 19% is incinerated, while less than 10% gets recycled. The proposed treaty, which had clear majority support among the over 100 countries that attended the gathering, would ban certain chemicals used in plastic production and penalize violations. The Biden administration supports reducing plastic pollution, but opposes mandatory production limits. The U.S. is the world's worst offender when it comes to plastics waste. Another attempt to reach an agreement will occur next year. An update from the humanitarian crisis in Gaza. The executive director of the relief organization Oxfam has said, quote, "Our staff in Gaza have been desperately trying for nearly 2 months to reach starving civilians, but have been blocked by the Israeli military." He's talking about an estimated 50,000 to 75,000 people. "We know that many children are trapped and will be starving to death. Israel's ethnic cleansing of the North Gaza governorate proves once more that it is operating with impunity from the dictates of international law. It is laying infrastructure for a long-term military presence, a de facto annexation of the land, and burning any hope of a just and peaceful solution. The international community remains impotent and in some cases fully complicit. This is a dark moment in history as Israel is subjecting thousands of men, women, and children to starvation as a weapon of war, while world leaders look on in full awareness and choose to do nothing." Israel has basically closed off northern Gaza to outside help. Thus, an Oxfam worker said, quote, "The north is cut off. There is only chaos and confusion, hunger and death. In the north, no one can help these people. No one, no food, no electricity, only famine. It's horrific to contemplate," unquote. But not horrific to Israel's far-right cabinet members. Finance Minister Bezalel Smotrich has called for annexation of occupied territory, saying, quote, "It is possible to create a situation where Gaza's population in 2 years will be less than half its current size." According to Smotrich, quote, "Encouraging voluntary emigration is an opportunity that arises with the Trump administration." He said similar things about the West Bank. Does Israel's ceasefire with Hezbollah, which the far right considers a big mistake, improve chances for a ceasefire with Hamas? Probably not. In fact, the one may further delay the other, although there is ongoing negotiation. For one thing, this ceasefire enables Netanyahu to improve his stance with the international community, fending off their criticism for a while at least. For another, Netanyahu accuses the Biden administration of forcing him to agree to a ceasefire with Hezbollah on penalty of an arms embargo. That gives him an out with the far right, even though the accusation is probably false. Donald Trump has stepped into this situation with a demand, mind you, that Hamas immediately release all the hostages or face the full power of the United States once he takes office. Now that's the kind of diplomacy only Netanyahu can appreciate. Finally, just when you think you've heard it all, here's an item from the Philippines, where the Vice President, Sara Duterte, daughter of the previous and dictatorial President, Rodrigo Duterte, shockingly declared that she had contracted an assassin to kill President Fernando Marcos Jr., his wife, and other top officials should she meet an untimely demise. No joke, she said. She and her father have made numerous criticisms of the Marcos government and have split with him over relations with China and other issues. Sara Duterte would have us believe her life is in danger. The Presidential Security Command said it has heightened and strengthened Marcos's security protocols. And that's the Global Citizen International Digest for the week. I'm Mel Gertov. Thanks for listening and take good care.
KABU News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Good evening. You're listening to KABU's News in Depth. I'm Eliza Yurkov. Bark is not just the stuff you find on trees. It's also a 25-year-old Portland-based forest conservation organization. In 1993, Greg Dyson and John Rancher were driven to protect Mount Hood National Forest from the vast clear cuts and old growth logging led by the Forest Service. They started ground truthing, or hiking around each timber sale, to closely observe ecological discrepancies in the land management. Bark's mission is simple: connect people to their place, and they'll work together to protect and steward it. Though it began as just a forest advocacy group, it's grown to include more than just the trees.
It still maintains a strong forest watch program run by Jordan Ladder that tracks timber sales and has expanded it to include energy transmission corridors, grazing allotments, and other destructive activities in Mount Hood. It also expanded with two more programs, one focused on restoration and the other on public education and outreach. Meg Waller leads the six-year-old restoration program and trains volunteers to conduct beaver habitat and wetland surveys. Haley Spotafora runs the education program that includes activist trainings, monthly guided hikes, environmental book clubs, and community meetings. Currently, BARC is preparing for the upcoming presidential administration change by deepening and expanding their community through an event called the Community Confluence Conference. The theme for the event is Tools for Change, evoking a sense that building community is one of those tools. I sat down with Jordan, Meg, and Haley, as well as Jade Hagen, the Director of Community Engagement and Communications. They will be hosting the event and discussed what to expect for BARC's largest annual event. So the Community Confluence Conference is on Saturday. It's technically the first annual of this title, but the former title was the People's Forest Forum. What changed and why?
BARC's work has expanded beyond like the traditional focus on when I say traditional, I'm thinking of other forest defense orgs that really do focus on forest policy, and we're still very much focused on that, but now we have this wonderful restoration program that's, you know, surveying for beaver habitat and wetlands, which actually is supporting our forest advocacy work, because when we identify these wetlands that aren't on the maps, we can get extra protections for them. And there's also this piece that we're really putting a lot of emphasis on right now, which is fire. And I already mentioned environmental justice. So I think another part of what has changed is that we're seeing the forest for more than just the trees and wanting to make sure that people that are involved in these other areas that may not be exactly forest related, but, you know, adjacent, are also welcome and included.
The event will be bringing together more than a dozen local organizations representing forest advocacy, wetland conservation, indigenous perspectives, and more. One of the participating organizations is Mantis VR. It worked with BARC over the summer to film Wetland 202, the second installment of BARC's wetland mapping verification training held at Clackamas Lake. Mantis VR will be using that drone footage at the conference for attendants to virtually experience beaver habitats and wetlands. This event serves as more than just an end-of-the-year fundraiser. Jordan, Haley, and Jade explain.
Kind of in the name, right? The Community Confluence. And that we sort of came up with that name well before we knew anything about this election or what might happen or any of that. I think that BARC has always been this way, and staff now are certainly the same, where we really want a focus on community. And through that lens, I think it's easy to do that through the lens of the environment, where the people who are living on the shared landscape are impacted by similar issues. They can be impacted in different ways, depending on that community, where they are, and a lot of the history and injustice tied to that. The focus is the same. And I think when you start to focus on especially environmental issues are often ones that bring people together. We might think of things a little differently, but in the end, like, we all want the same things, you know, clean water to drink, clean air to breathe, and these places where we can go and connect, you know, with the land. Connecting broad national issues to a place, a singular place that we all have in common, I think can be really powerful. And it also just have to like try to have some positivity, that like, hey, there's a bunch of folks around us that really care about this stuff. Like, we're not alone.
I think that's my goal for this conference, is to give people some very tangible places to begin and the framework that they can kind of hang their hopes up on.
You know, it comes down to people power. That's like really what BARC's always been about. Like, all of our wins have been volunteer driven. I mean, we're hoping that we're going to bring a lot of people together and that they're going to find a way that they can take action in the very near future.
The conference will feature three different panels. Jordan will be hosting the discussion on wildfires, Meg on beaver conservation, and Jade on environmental justice.
Again, this is Jordan. I'm hosting, I think they are titled Flames for Change. Issue of our time as it relates to forests is wildfire. So on my panel, we have three members. Andrew Spaeth, he's the facilitator for two forest collaboratives that oversee things on the east side of the forest. And those collaborative groups are made up of a bunch of different diverse interests and backgrounds. That collaborative is hosted, will help to fund fire history research on the Mount Hood that is going to shed light on what role fire played past and maybe give us some hints on like what needs to happen in the future. So then the other person, Simone Cordery-Cotter, she's a fire risk reduction specialist with Oregon State Fire Marshal. And she speaks to at-risk community members all the time in her work. That's her specialty, communicating issues about what you can do around your home or your community, defensible space and home hardening and evacuation planning. The third panelist, his name is Max Oakes. He's an enrolled member with the Confederated Tribes of Warm Springs. He's also a staff biologist with the tribe. The way that the tribe might burn in a way that reflects like the values that they're managing for with that burn, and how are they thinking about the historic homelands, which is Mount Hood? Yeah, the usual and custom areas for hunting and gathering and fishing. How does fire play a role in all of this? And that's my goal. Set the stage for what the role of fire was in these forests in the past, how all of that changed really quickly, 100, 150 years ago, with indigenous people being removed from the land, their practices halted, and then with a strict like fire suppression policy by the Forest Service, really has played a huge part in leading us today to where wildfires across the West in really scary ways. Fire is terrifying, it's traumatic, it's scary, it's also restorative and renewing and critical. And it's all those things at the same time.
I'll be putting on a beaver panel. Our favorite little furry restoration specialists. I have four panelists. I have Shay Fuller from the Wetlands Conservancy. She's the community engagement manager. She does a lot of the beaver habitat surveys with on their properties, which tend to be in the more in the metro area versus ours are up on the mountain. So it's a nice, interesting dichotomy between the work that we're doing that's similar and yet very different. I also have Jeff Goldberg, the Westside Wildlife Biologist from the Forest Service, coming. He does a lot of the restoration work over there. He helps me find places to survey for beaver. We work pretty closely. I also have Ben Cate from the ODFW, is also a wildlife biologist who does a lot of the beaver work with the ODFW that's sort of just beginning and building up pretty quickly. I also have Brian Bangs from the ODFW, who is an aquatic biologist, who is another big beaver believer. I'm also really excited to talk with my panelists about a new bill that was introduced on the 6th. So just a couple days ago, that allocates $3 million per year for the next handful of years for beaver mitigation and coexistence. Pretty exciting stuff. I think one of my big goals for my panel was just clearing up there's a lot of confusion about beaver reintroduction and how difficult it is. Beavers move a lot. There's a lot of legislation that we're still making a lot of progress on. We've had some really big wins this year that I'm definitely going to talk about, but there's a lot more work to do.
I have the Environmental Justice on Shared Lands panel, and the origin of this panel was really this idea as the resident humanist of BARC. You know, I work with so many exceptional and talented scientists. That's not my background, but in my experience, I see climate and environmental issues as like first and foremost social and cultural issues. We have the solutions scientifically. We often have the technical solutions, but it usually comes down to cultural narratives. And so I really wanted to think about how use environmental justice and the various discourses around that to change the narratives, various topics related to the work we do at BARC. So I've got Ame Mignon Ferguson from Parrot Creek, who we work with. And she's going to be talking a little bit about her project at Parrot Creek to restore this 80-acre site to be an active natural resource and a natural area for Indigenous and BIPOC communities in the urban Portland metro area, you know, for urban natives that can't access places like Mount Hood for various reasons. Justice is baked into that project. The way that particular land management project is being used. And I've got Madison Fowler from University of Oregon. She's in a Northwest Forest Plan Just Futures working group that's looking at the role of environmental justice in the Northwest Forest Plan amendment. It's the first amendment of this Northwest Forest Plan in its 30-year history, so it's a really big deal. And environmental justice wasn't a part of it, nor were the tribes in the original draft. And so she's doing some very important work with a group of scholars and community members and other nonprofits down in Eugene to make recommendations and submit comments and spread the word about the role of environmental justice in land management as it pertains to this forest plan. And then third panelist is David Osborne, a former BARC board member. Actually, I think played a central role in starting the beaver restoration work and works very closely to this day with Meg. He teaches a course at PSU on environmental justice and salmon. And so I think he also shares some of my instincts about the role of narrative and sociocultural elements and is exploring that with his students, and his students work with Meg.
How will BARC keep up the momentum from the conference to maintain that community that you're building?
That's the big question. How do we keep going? Internally at BARC, we are taking like a whole week in January to come together as a staff. We want to increase volunteer engagement in all varieties of ways. More people on field days, more people helping to organize events and sharing their knowledge. You can only know so much as an individual, and there are, what, like 8 or 9 of us now. There's a lot more to know than, you know, 8 or 9 people can know. So
I think this week in January will be a good time to plan what our core campaigns are going to be. And I no doubt that will be influenced by what comes out of this conference. And there's probably things that we can't even imagine at this time because it hasn't happened yet. We've really been working on getting systems in place for like routing our volunteers. And I think volunteer power is going to be a big part, just like community, of the next few years.
In the water-based world, one of the things that is very likely going to come under attack is the protection specifically for the type of wetland that BARC surveys for. Mm-hmm. So we focus on these little, very small, generally detached wetlands. Some of them in the middle of the summer, you wouldn't really know were wetlands unless you knew what to look for. Mm-hmm. Last year, the Supreme Court